Dr. Sally here. Welcome to Flourishing Fully Podcasts. Today I have the pleasure of introducing McKay Rippey, an acupuncture specialist for close to 30 years. McKay trained at the Thai Sophia Institute and now practices in rural Clinton, New York. He is a five-element acupuncturist following the laws of nature to diagnose in accordance with those laws and to work therapeutically to restore balance and harmony. He is a farmer, a lacrosse fan, and a family man. I was particularly drawn to McKay because of his interest in and compassion for people with Lyme disease. He is the host of Lyme Ninja Radio. Welcome, McKay.
Thank you so much. I usually don't think myself as a lacrosse man and a family man and a farmer. So it's nice to hear those things reflected back because they're true.
They are true. So how did you get interested in acupuncture?
Oh, my goodness. This is one of those serendipitous moments. And it probably started, I grew up in Washington, D.C., in a small row house in Adams Morgan. And about a block away from us was this massive bridge spanning Rock Creek Park. So if you walked across this bridge, and we walked across it to go to church and school, you could see north and south this amazing view of Rock Creek Park. So even though I was stuck in the middle of the city, and our front yard was just a tiny, tiny little thing, and surrounded by cement, there's this beautiful ribbon of green that just moves through the city. And my first school that I went to was a Montessori school on an old mansion in Northwest. And one of my first teachers was a park ranger. So here I am in the middle of the city, and I've got this amazing connection with nature. And it seems even more exotic because, again, my backyard was cement and my front yard was mostly cement. And then there's all this nature around me. We're also a couple blocks from the zoo. So in the morning, you could hear the howler monkeys getting started. So it's this strange juxtaposition. So fast forward about 20-some years later, I'm in college studying English literature, and my father, really unbeknownst to me, had started acupuncture, but he made a donation to the school, the local school, and they sent him a magazine that showed up about twice a year. And I started reading this on my breaks, and there's one winter afternoon, I'm sitting in the sunshine reading about acupuncture and really the philosophy behind it, and the little voice and the light bulb goes off and says, I'm going to study this. And I was about 22 years old, and that was it. There was no thought, there was no thinking, there was no planning. It's just, I'm going to do this. And here we are, like you said, almost 30 years later.
Beautiful, beautiful story. So for a lot of our listeners, what is acupuncture?
Ha! So I've been doing this for almost 30 years. I'm still not sure what it is. But what probably at the heart of acupuncture is observation. And it starts with nature and the observation of what happens at different times of year. And I believe actually like the five element theory, which I'm trained in, is really a roadmap for how to live, survive in nature. And sometime 2,000-3,000 years ago, somebody said, you know what? We've got this roadmap on how to survive in nature, kind of follow the rhythms of the season. I wonder if that holds true for inside and an individual as well. And they started applying this map to people. And the theory that holds it all together is this idea of energy. And depending on who you talk to, there is energy or there isn't energy. And I'm agnostic. I use the concept of energy all the time. So I'm not agnostic. I believe, but I'm not. I don't feel that you have to believe in energy to understand acupuncture. So anyway, so they take this idea that nature's flowing around us, and that if you are in proper attunement with the natural flows, you will be healthy. And somewhere along the line, the story goes that this man gets conscripted into the army, and he has terrible, he probably has IBS. He can't eat anything except for broth and boiled rice. And he goes to war and gets an arrow in his leg, and all of a sudden he can eat all the spicy, everything he wants to eat. And he says, I'm cured. And he says, it must have been the arrow in his leg. So that's the myth of how acupuncture started. So again, it starts with observation and what we can see. So it's not, you know, it's a different type of medicine. It's not based on test results and numbers and things like that. It's really what intervention makes a difference. And as you know, acupuncture can use needles. The Russians started using lasers. There are people using tuning forks. We've done hands-on. You can do cupping. Of course, the Chinese herbs. So it's really what interventions, you know, really acupuncture, Chinese medicine is all that. It's not just the needles. The needles are one small part of it.
Does the system that you use use meridians to balance the energy?
Yeah, absolutely. So the technical explanation is there's energy coursing through the body, just like there's traffic everywhere in and around a city. But there are major pathways, major roadways where the cars gather, where the energy gathers and moves. And then there are these intersections along these roadways, and the intersections have functions to them. It's like along this intersection, perhaps more more circulation happens, or along this intersection, something to do with the muscles happens. So the point, the intersections get literally blocked up. And what I think happens is the needle releases a small electrical charge that's built up and kind of clogged up the flow of this energy. So you release the flow of the energy and the function begins again. So the acupuncture isn't treating an organ per se, but it's treating the energy that allows that organ to manifest and affect the rest of the body.
And that energy relay is virtually instantaneous, is it not?
That is one of the most bizarre things that I still have trouble wrapping my mind about. Let me tell you a story. When I had just gotten out of acupuncture school, I was probably still doing my clinical training. We had three children at the time. We're in a small apartment outside of Baltimore, and my youngest child wakes up with night terrors. Now, if you've ever had a child with night terrors, they're screaming at the top of their lungs, and they're not awake. And she's about a year and a half. So, you know, we've had crying children before. So we try and wake her up. Okay, we rock her, we soothe her, we sing to her. We try to warm up a bottle, we give her a bottle, and it's not working. It seems like 3 hours, right? It's probably been like 3 minutes. We're starting to sweat. It's like the neighbors are going to start pounding on the floor soon. And so we try, okay, let's try and change her environment. Let's put her in a warm bath. Okay, that doesn't work. So now we're getting desperate. So, okay, well, how about if I smack her on the bottom and kind of shock her awake and maybe that'll work. So I smacked her bottom and still she's just screaming at the top of her lungs and arching her back and all that. And then the thought occurs, well, let's try acupuncture. So here I have this screaming 1.5-year-old, and there's a point on the ankle that has to do with fear and quiet. So it's one of these intersections. It's the source point of the kidney. It's called Greater Mountain Stream. So it has to do, the kidney's all about the depth of winter and quiet and also cooling things down. And this, the emotion associated with the kidney is fear. And so that's a point I chose. I put the needle in the sleeping, screaming child. She screamed slightly louder for half a second, and on the second half of that second, she was back asleep.
Beautiful.
And so at that point, it's like, okay, you know, there's some argument, you know, this is years and years ago, that this may all be placebo. However, here's a screaming child who's asleep. We put a needle in her, and instantaneously, and it wasn't like a minute later, it was like a light switch, instantaneously she's back asleep. So yeah, it's the healing, the energy shifts instantaneously, and depending on what needs to heal, then the body can recover afterwards. So the healing can take some time, and sometimes there are more than, you know, one or two blocks that have accumulated over years, so they need to be addressed as time goes on. But the movement of energy is instantaneous.
Right. I'm reading a book now that indicates that it's along the pathways of the fascia. That's the connective tissue lining that surrounds all the organs. And is that your thinking, or how do you see it?
That's one of the theories out there, and I think that one holds some water. I think acupuncture has several pathways that it uses. So I think at this point in time, there may be one that we figure out, you know, science eventually figures out, yeah, this is the main one. But I think it's actually affecting on several layers, and I think that's one reason it's so hard to pin down. There's some work by Dr. Gerald Pollack. He's got a lab out in the University of Washington, and he's doing some work on the structuring of water and the electrical charge of water, and particularly how it works inside the body. And I think acupuncture is tapping literally into this very subtle energy, literally, like electrical flow, and that there are pathways, kind of these self-organizing pathways that get formed in life, in human beings, and also, you know, mammals and other animals like that. They don't have a wall to them. But I think the electricity flows along this pathway, and again, there's these junction points that are the acupuncture points. And if the charge gets too great there, then the flow literally stops. And nobody's sure what's passing along these pathways. It may be electrical communication signals. It might be DNA, RNA kind of stuff. We don't know yet. But definitely these pathways do move along the fascia as well. And because most of the points are in spaces in between muscles, in between bones and muscles, in between tendons. You know, people ask you, well, what are you putting the needle into? Is it a nerve? It's really spaces. If I accidentally hit your nerve when I'm needling, we both know about it because it's an unpleasant event. It's like hitting your funny bone. It burns and tingles and zings and lasts for a while. But the release that you feel with an acupuncture needle, and this is, we get a little controversial here. Some people say, oh, acupuncture, you shouldn't feel anything at all. I disagree completely. When that tiny little electrical charge is released, there is a sensation. You know, it's a burst. It's a firework. It can be kind of dull and achy, but most of the time it's a little flash. And the body picks up on that, and there's a sensation. It pinches. You know, there is a sensation there.
How big is the area that you're targeting?
So what's interesting as the water around the point gets disorganized, it gets softer. So as a point needs to be needled more, it gets bigger and bigger. But the actual point itself is really tiny. And there'll be times where I'm needling a point trying to find it, oh, 3-4, you know, on a bad day, half a dozen times. Now, the good news is if you miss a point, you don't feel much of anything. So it doesn't hurt every time you insert the needle, but and this can all be within like a little quarter inch circle. It's very, very precise.
Very precise. And so people should expect to experience some discomfort, although I know when I having acupuncture for a tune-up or balancing my body, I breathe out, and that, you know, when with the thrust of the wrist, and that kind of numbs or dissipates the sensation.
Yeah, I have patients who said, oh, I'm so glad that you taught me the breathing, because when I go get my blood drawn or get a shot, the nurses don't tell me to do that, but I do it on my own, and it's much better that way. Anytime our body tenses up, things are just going to hurt more. And I don't want to, you know, most people are shocked at the nature of the sensation with acupuncture, and not in a bad way, because it again, I think it's a release of electricity, so it only lasts, the sensation lasts less than a second. So by the time your body kind of flinches a little bit, or you recognize, it's already gone. And you, I'm sure you've had that experience too. It's so quick. I tell people, I used to try to explain this, and people would, their eyes would roll in the back of their head. People say, do needles hurt? And they just want a simple explanation. So I say, it pinches. So if you can stand a pinch, you can stand acupuncture.
Right. And so you have the needle put, placed, and some acupuncturists will twirl the needle, and then you lie on the table for a period of time. If acupuncture is instantaneous, why do you have to lie there for the duration?
This gets into a very interesting area, and there are different needle techniques, and different schools of acupuncture teach different techniques. And this goes way back. Each family in a village or a city would have their style of acupuncture. And then there would be traveling monks who would kind of cross-pollinate the ideas. And eventually, about 2,000 years ago, the first acupuncture books were commissioned by the emperor, the Chinese emperor at the time, and things started getting written down. So in general, most of the acupuncture that's done is done with needles left in. Now, in my style, most of the needling is done with an in-and-out insertion that lasts all of a second. And there'll be times where we do leave the needle in when we're trying to calm energy down. I don't mean to insult. I'm not trying to insult people. I think some of the styles of acupuncture where they use 30 needles and leave them in is because their point location is good, but not like they're 80% there. And the same for like electrical stimulation of the acupuncture points. Again, if you miss the point by a little bit, you can still get an effect. And this is one of the confounding things when they study acupuncture. You put a needle in somebody and you're going to get a response by the body. But you hit the acupuncture point and it's multiplied when you get it right on. There's a study by Columbia and a hospital in Hong Kong showing this. They were all excited because they found this chemical cascade, this calcium channel cascade that happened when they were doing some treatment. But what they found is when they got the point right on, this cascade was multiplied. It like doubled. So the accuracy matters a lot. So if you have the needle nearby the point, if you leave it in, I think you get the effect as opposed to really having to spend lots of time getting it precisely on. So again, this is not an insult. It's just a different way of approaching it. They've done lots of studies comparing different types of acupuncture. They all work. There's no one better. You know, it's more about your relationship with the practitioner and your affinity for the style they do rather than is one better than the other.
I want to ask you about that, but first I'd like to ask you, McKay, how do you imagine or know that acupuncture is affecting the mitochondria, which are the little powerhouses of the cell?
Holy smokes. It's funny. So this is going to be a long answer. I apologize. Acupuncture is 2,000 years old and it's Chinese. And so again, they're looking at these minor, mild interventions and then looking at what response there is to it. So did people have fatigue 2,000 years ago? Absolutely. Did they have any idea what mitochondria was? Absolutely not. So they had concepts like Jing, and that's spelled J-I-N-G. We transliterated as Jing. And Jing is this kind of DNA deep source energy that we have, kind of our potential energy and the energy that fuels us through our life and through our day. So there are treatments to bolster Jing. Now, are these treatments affecting the ATP and the mitochondria and the citric acid cycle and all that? Probably. The studies haven't been done yet, so we can't say for sure. But definitely, you talk to people who have acupuncture, is, you know, one of the common things actually is people will get more tired right after a treatment and then feel the energy the next day. Or later on in the day. And I have a client who comes in and she basically has to take a walk around the block before she gets in her car because she feels spacey and loopy and just very, very relaxed. But she's a hardcore amateur bicyclist and does all kinds of racing and online stuff. And this is one of the things that keeps you going, giving you lots of energy. So yes, does acupuncture build your reserves and your strength and help you recover like that? Absolutely. Do we know it's influencing the ATP? I haven't seen studies. Maybe somebody's studying that. I just assume it is, and kind of leave that type of spot on hardcore science to more the nutrition side of my practice, or the sleep study side of my practice, and leave the acupuncture to deal with Jing and water energy and restoration and deep yin and things like that.
Great. So how do you know you've got a good acupuncturist?
You feel better.
But there are some conditions that take some time.
Like Lyme disease.
Lyme disease.
So I'll take a stab at that. So I kind of half jokingly said you'll feel better, I mean that seriously. On some level, you're going to feel better, and maybe it's not the main symptom, your main complaint that you came in. When I was in training, my teacher studied with J.R. Worsley, who's a British gentleman. He's since passed away, but his clinic was in England, and he came and toured through the States and would promote acupuncture and promote his school. So they went and studied with him, and he helped them set up the school that I went to. And the British had a phrase back then, and it went something like, "I feel better within myself." And so maybe you're coming in for your back pain. And here's a story. This way back when I was in Southern Maryland, this man comes in, and what got him in the door, men are very reluctant to seek medical care. It's part of our nature. What got him on the door, he bought his 5-year-old daughter a bicycle for her birthday, and he couldn't teach her to ride it because his back hurt too much. So finally said, okay, I got to do something about this back. And he finally makes his way into my office. So we're a couple treatments in, and he says, Does acupuncture work on your emotions? And I say, well, why do you ask that? He said, well, I'm in my weekly sales meeting, and these meetings are very contentious, and the fur's flying, and I'm usually right in the middle of it. And he said, this time I was just kind of leaning back in my chair and watching these guys attack each other, and I didn't get sucked into it. He said, I thought that was very strange. I said, yes, acupuncture in getting balanced, in when your energy, when these pathways are moving, when these intersections are open and flowing, everything functions better. And so eventually his back got better, but it wasn't the first thing to get better. So he knew he was feeling better on some level, even though the back pain was a little more stubborn and took some healing. So again, the energy changes instantaneously. So your mood can change instantaneously. I've seen pain disappear instantaneously when it's more like a neurological type pain. But if there's healing that needs to be done, the body needs some time and support to do the healing. So things can take a while there. But if you have a good connection, you feel a good connection with this person, you understand what they're doing, they're explaining to you what's going on there, you know, they're not selling you the sun and the moon, telling you that they're going to cure everything instantaneously, and you have a good sense of this, and at some level you're feeling healthier, then you probably have a pretty good acupuncturist.
Great. So there's a lot of talk today about toxins and having the toxins affect the terrain of the body. Will acupuncture work if you're toxic?
Acupuncture helps the body function to its fullest capacity. That said, we're finding with a lot of this genetic study that there are pathways that are broken and that we need extra support. And this is kind of where the yang of acupuncture and the yin of Chinese herbal and dietary therapy come in. So let's say, for example, that your body has a bricklayer inside, and the bricklayer is tired and worn out, and the acupuncture can kind of motivate the bricklayer to do its job better within the body, and let's say rebuild tendons. Let's say the bricklayer is part of the body that rebuilds tendons. But if the bricklayer doesn't have bricks, it could be the best bricklayer in the world, doesn't have bricks, then it doesn't matter. Right. You also, you need both. You need the yin and the yang. You need the capacity, the function, but you also need the raw materials. So there can be a time where acupuncture doesn't work because it's not an issue of the bricklayer. It's an issue of the brick. So you need to be able to see both. It's not an either or. And you know, that's where some of the acupuncture miracles come in. It's because there's tons of bricks lying around, and the bricklayer is just, for whatever, off the job, and the acupuncture kind of wakes up the bricklayer, calls them back to work, and all of a sudden the healing can begin again.
Great. How did you get interested in Lyme disease, McKay?
Two intersecting pathways. The first is probably the minor pathway. I got bit myself about 12 years ago. And luckily, my wife, when we were in Maryland, she worked for the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health in their PR department. And I would tease her that she would come home every day with a new way to die. And one of the things that they got interested at some point was Lyme disease. So she was doing stories of Lyme disease, and she would talk about it. And it's like, okay, that's an interesting disease, especially this whole bullseye rash thing. That's, you know, kind of curious. But it's at this point, you know, it's 30 years ago. It's a minor thing. And even now, the CDC and the infectious disease people really aren't owning up to the seriousness of this epidemic, this pandemic. So fast forward, we're up in New York. I'm down along the Hudson River visiting some friends, and I must have gotten bit. I didn't feel it. I didn't see the tick, but I got home. I went to do some Aikido and got overheated in the summer day in this little tiny studio. It was me, a senior student. I was just a beginner, and the instructor. And they were just throwing me all over the room, and I worked up a really good sweat and exhausted me. And then I got this worst summer flu, the worst flu I've ever had. I was like, oh, wow, these guys really killed me. So I'm feeling sorry for myself. I'm a really bad patient, miserable, you know, all the typical flu symptoms, tired, cranky, achy. And Sunday morning, I was dragging myself to the bathroom saying, when is this ever going to stop? And I look in the mirror, and there on my arm was a perfect, perfect bullseye rash. And I thought to myself, oh, this is Lyme disease. And one of those bizarre moments, too, talking about things changing instantly, I felt better instantly. Now, I was still sick. So we bundled myself up, went down to the ER, and the doctor said, well, it sure looks like Lyme disease. You know, again, this is the first one we've ever seen here in central New York. Do you mind if everybody on duty comes by and looks at the rash? Because we want everybody to see this. So every nurse, everybody came through the room and looked at the rash and said, thank you very much. And I got my 2 weeks of doxycycline. And luckily, this was all within days. So it was just enough to slow down the replication of the Lyme disease, to let my immune system, you know, still fairly young, otherwise fairly healthy. And I followed up with some acupuncture and some herbal tinctures, a teasel tincture, I believe. And really, for the most part, my wife says I lost some of my hairline, and I think that's true. And I probably lost some of my Jing, so my ATP function. I'm not quite as energetic as I feel I should be. I just kind of run out of energy a little more often than I should, I think. So I'm at like 90% or 95%, something like that. So that happened. And then just kind of moved along. And then all of a sudden, people in this area started showing up with Lyme disease. And I started hearing about it. And I have a mentor. His name's Greg Lee. He's in Frederick, Maryland. He's an acupuncturist. I went to school with him. And he's also an expert, far more than I am, on Lyme disease. He's willing to try. Anyway, he's just a genius and just scouring the world for different treatment modalities. And I knew that existed. So I went to go train with him. It's like he taught me that the traditional medicine is so underserving this population. And I'm thinking, if this is happening here in my neighborhood, I've got to take care of these people because their doctors won't. You know, it's just who knows when Western medicine is going to catch up. Hopefully soon, but at this point it isn't. So I felt it was a mission of mine to take care of these people. And, you know, as I've started getting known a little bit for working with Lyme disease, they're just coming out of the woodworks. You know, they're just people everywhere who have chronic Lyme disease. Some of them know it and some of them don't.
Yes, some of them don't. what can acupuncture do for Lyme specifically?
The needles themselves aren't particularly effective in getting rid of the bacteria. And that's partly the nature of this particular bacteria. There's this concept in Chinese medicine called Gu syndrome. And essentially, goo is described as oil seeping into flour, and then the practitioner's job is to separate out the flour and the oil after they've mixed together. So it's this very sticky condition. And so acupuncture can help normally with, I help people with just normal flus and viruses all the time, and they tend to speed up their recovery and so forth and so on. But the Lyme bacteria and some of the, especially when you have the co-infections folded in there, become more, it's like more than the bricklayer can handle. So the needles can help with your spirit. So they can make you feel calmer. They can help some with the sleep. They can help keep you motivated. So that's a part of acupuncture we don't talk about a lot. And then you start bringing in associated techniques. So you can do some cupping or wet cupping. You can bring in Chinese medicine. You can bring in essential oils. You can do frequency-specific microcurrent type things and these other alternative treatments. The needles themselves can be super helpful, and acupuncturists can be a wonderful person to make somebody feel listened to and taken care of and kind of coordinate the big picture of things, especially if there isn't a Lyme literate person around, or if, you know, you've reached at, look, at some point, a practitioner, whether it's an acupuncturist, a doctor, a Lyme literate doctor, a spiritual healer, at some point, your practitioner takes you through the eye of the needle and you come out healed. Or I bump up against my own blindness, my own places where I haven't been able to heal yet, and I take the person as far as they can go, and they need to go see somebody else. So I encourage people in my practice and in the Lyme community also, is like, you know, ride this horse, ride your relationship with your practitioner as long as you can. But once you feel like progress has stopped, it doesn't diminish your relationship and the success you've had with your practitioner. It just may be that's all they have to offer, and you need to find somebody else. So that's a very long answer to the question, is like acupuncture. The needles themselves are a small part of treatment with Lyme disease, but they can be a crucial component.
Right. Well, they can also, you're not really focused on symptoms, but you can address the pain, the anxiety, the insomnia, the mood changes that go along with Lyme.
Exactly. And that's back to really particularly five element acupuncture. And we're trained. You're not treating the symptoms. In fact, don't chase the symptoms around. What you're doing is you're treating a person's causative factor, the foundational energy wobble or disturbance that leads all the pathways. So we're trying to get as far upstream, like we're trying to find the cause of the pollution as far upstream as we can and remove that, so that all downstream, everything begins to heal on its own self naturally, rather than going downstream and trying to save, you know, the minnows and trying to save the crawfish and trying to save the frogs individually. Like, we want to go all the way upstream. It's like, what's poisoning this river? You know, what can we change all the way at the beginning? So we have a law we call the law of least action. The perfect acupuncture treatment is somebody comes into your office, you shake their hands and look them in the eye and say hello, and they're healed. You know, you get them on such a deep level that's the intervention. Now, obviously, you know, things can be much more complicated than that, mostly limited by our ability to see clearly what's going on. But I, in my practice, I'm always trying to take needles away. What's the center point? And that's really a five-element type of treatment strategy and design. We're really kind of Taoist that way, Taoist and Zen.
You deal with a lot with, let's just say, pain.
Mm-hmm.
Do people come to see you first for pain, or where are you in the line of seeking assistance? Where are the acupuncturists?
In my community, we're at the bottom. So by the time somebody's come to see me, they have a chiropractor, they have a massage therapist, they've been to several medical specialists, and they're kind of this in-between space. So it's not so severe that they're incapacitated, but it's definitely impacting their life. And they don't like their options. Their options are either the doctor said, well, gee, I don't know what we can do for you, or here, you're going to have to go on these medications or narcotics, or we're going to do surgery. And the person says, you know, that doesn't sound right to me. At some level, their intuition says, this isn't the right thing. So, but they also have to be motivated. Some people just become resigned at this point. Well, I got to live with this. But there are other people said, you know what, there's got to be another way. And in asking that question, acupuncture all of a sudden rises to the top. So then they start talking to their neighbors, and, oh, yeah, you know, my neighbor Bob, he tried acupuncture, and it helped with his, you know, fill in the blank. And so the lines start intersecting, and eventually somebody gets my name and number, and then they give me a call. But out here, we're at the bottom of the list. Now, maybe in San Francisco or New York City or Boston or something, acupuncture is higher up the list. But right here, where I'm often the stop of last resort.
So that's a reflection of people's resistance to think outside the box in seeking assistance?
That's a very interesting. I'm stalling. When I'm interviewing people, they'll say this when they need to think a little bit. That's a very interesting question.
Well, just to show that this hasn't been rehearsed.
Exactly. I think it's a combination of things. So first of all, there's the financial part of things, right? And we've been trained to not pay for medical care.
Absolutely.
Now, that's starting to shift as the copays are going up and up. I mean, copays used to be $10-$15, and now they're $50-$75. So people are getting used to paying out money when they go to see a medical practitioner. So that's starting to shift things a little bit. But still, it's like, wait a minute, I've already paid for everything up front. It's like, you know, you go to the medical buffet, you pay your insurance, and it's all you can eat. It's supposed to be all you can eat after that. And that's beginning to break up. So part of it is just financial. You know, people aren't made of money. Most people aren't. So there is a financial consideration to it that I think is a big part. The other part with acupuncture is the needles. And our experiences early on with needles aren't the best. So, you know, it's something else to overcome. And then it's just familiarity. We haven't had our Tiger Woods. So Tiger Woods came along and all of a sudden everybody was playing golf. It's like we're not – I tease other practitioners around here. It's like we're not – around here, if for a restaurant to succeed, it needs to be in the middle. It's like we had an Indian restaurant come in, and even though we're a college town, it's like people were curious in the beginning and then the traffic fell off. We're not mainstream. Everybody's heard of it. Oh, this is a great story. I had a patient come in once and said, you know, I've been thinking about acupuncture and trying to help get the word out because I really like it and think a lot of people would benefit. He said, but you know, there's a fundamental problem. I said, oh, that's interesting because I think about it a lot. And she said, well, here's your problem. She said, acupuncture is like cannibalism. I said, what? What are you talking about? It's nothing like cannibalism. She said, hang on. She said, everybody's heard of it, but nobody does it. It's like, oh, okay, I see your point here. So I did the numbers, and essentially the numbers are equal to people who jump out of airplanes for fun. So there are as many acupuncture treatments as there are parachute jumps in a year in the U.S. And so it's the same sort of thing. It's we're still rare birds. Everybody's heard of us, but it's not we haven't made the leap. It's like yoga made the leap, whatever that was, 10, 15 years ago. Yoga used to be just kind of this thing that some strange people did. People traveled to India and did yoga and the weird thing. And then all of a sudden, everybody's doing it. It's like there are 100 yoga places around here in church basements and art centers and everywhere. Every corner there's a yoga class. But acupuncture hasn't made that leap yet. So, you know, at some point somebody may popularize it, or it might be that there's just enough resistance that, you know, maybe it just never quite gets there. Maybe we're just this special little group. But I like to think that we can make the leap in popularity. You know, it's like we need the right celebrity or the right TV show to bring it to the mainstream.
Acupuncture certainly wasn't taught in medical school when I was in medical school, albeit that's a long time ago. But
you mean not yesterday?
Not yesterday. Not remotely close. But I doubt that to any significant degree, much like nutrition, is not a big topic in medical school. So I think that if we can get the medical community, the conventional medical community, to be more, to embrace it more, that it will be accepted more.
I was standing in line, and I was in acupuncture school in Baltimore, Mondawmin Mall, so one of these miserable DMV places. And of course, because we're in a stressful situation, you become foxhole buddies with the people around you. And this old Jewish man turns around and says, "You know, so son, you know, tell me a little bit about yourself." I said, "Well, I'm in school. I'm getting my master's degree." "Oh, master's degree, that's wonderful. What are you studying?" "Acupuncture." And his brow furrows. He goes, acupuncture. How long are you studying?" And I said, "Well, it's a 3-year, you know, it's a 3-year program." "3 years?" You know, it gets all animated. "3 years? You could be a doctor. What do you want to study acupuncture for?" So I gave my stock answer. I said, "You know, I don't like blood." He goes, "Okay." But it's the physicians, they have so much on their plate. The school I went to had a little bit of a relationship with Hopkins School of Medicine, and there was a rotation where the doctors could come through and get exposed to acupuncture. And there is a group of, they call themselves medical acupuncturists, and they, you know, their training is varied. I'm one of the people who says the more people doing acupuncture, the better. I'm not like, there's some acupuncturists who get very territorial and say, "No, only an acupuncturist can do acupuncture and nobody else can." But in my mind, the more the merrier. You know, I'm trying to make this gap from kind of this fringe medicine to mainstream. So because of these doctors doing acupuncture, like, doctors don't, for the most part, do nutrition, although that's changed with functional medicine. Doctors don't do chiropractic, you know, except for a few weird osteopath people, right, quote-unquote weird. But there are quite a few doctors who do acupuncture, and this has helped lessen the resistance. And it doesn't mean that doctors are embracing acupuncture, but at least they're not hostile to it. They used to be hostile to acupuncture. And at this point, they're much more willing to kind of support a patient who's going to try acupuncture, and in some kind of sticky cases, even refer. Like within the past month, I got a referral from a urologist who referred a Lyme patient. And that's a rare event, especially up here.
Tell us you have a brain fog breathing technique.
I do. Thanks for bringing that up. So one of the things I noticed with my Lyme patient, I have gadgets in my office, so I've got this weird kind of love of technology. And one of the things I measure for every patient every time they come in is their blood oxygen level. And it's, you know, it's just one of those simple little clips that goes on a fingertip and uses infrared light to somehow make a calculation. And I found consistently that the Lyme patients have low blood oxygen. And as you know, the brain's a very hungry organ. It needs lots of oxygen and lots of fuel to make it work properly. And almost everybody who has Lyme at some point has brain fog in various degrees, to the point where they forget where they are or where they're driving, to just having trouble accessing words, kind of more normal brain fog type of things. And so in researching that, I came across an old Ayurvedic technique that's got some science. They've studied this some, and it's alternate nostril breathing. So I combined alternate nostril breathing with controlled breathing. So there are many breathing techniques where you take deep breaths in, you hold your breath, and you exhale. And this helps not only the oxygen get through your lungs into your bloodstream, but then helps the oxygen in your bloodstream get into the tissues. One of the things that happens is when we're stressed, we hyperventilate. We actually have an insufficiency of carbon dioxide in the body because we've expelled it all. And carbon dioxide in small amounts acts as a signaling molecule telling the oxygen where it needs to go. So if you've cleared out all your carbon dioxide, you can have lots of oxygen in your bloodstream, but it's not getting to the organs. And that's when somebody hyperventilates and passes out, that's what's happening. It's like they've got lots of blood oxygen, they're at 100% saturation, but it's not getting to the brain. So And then you combine this with alternate nostril breathing, which is this funny little crossing the midline type of thing. And there's studies showing that it helps synchronize the brain. And one of the effects of brain fog, the damage that we have, is that the left and right hemispheres, their communication breaks down some. So you put these two together, and so you've got this relaxing, oxygenating tempo breathing thing combined with the alternate nostril breathing. It can really help your brain kind of get back into sync, relax, and clear some of this brain fog.
So can you in a couple of steps say, okay, close off one nostril, breathe deep?
Yep.
Can you go through that sequence?
Sure. So I start with my right thumb on my right nostril and exhale for 4 seconds, hold for 4 seconds, breathe in for 4 seconds, and hold for 4 seconds. So it's a 16-second cycle, and then you switch. Then I use my right index finger, close off my left nostril, and then start again. So breathe out, 4 seconds out, 4 seconds hold, 4 seconds in, and 4 seconds hold again. So you're holding your breath twice in between these really deep breaths. You're really trying to clear out your lungs or fill them up as much as you can quickly. And it's the holding that really allows the oxygen to start moving back and forth between the lungs and the bloodstream, and also the bloodstream and then the tissues. And then the alternating, it's just one of those weird little midline things. And I don't think anybody has a real explanation for why that works, but it definitely just helps the brain. It helps you wake up. So if you're stressed, don't do this at night because it'll wake you up. It's not a relaxation technique. It's really a focusing and livening technique. There are other techniques you can do to help your brain relax, to help you get to sleep. So don't do this at night.
And there are some, when I was studying pranic healing, they would say to increase the period of the hold, you know, from 4 seconds to 5 to 6. How do you feel about that?
For this particular technique, I don't think it's necessary. I think that as other techniques, absolutely, you can do that. You could bring it up to 5. Essentially, slowing your breath down slows your heart rate down and really helps the body kind of get into sync. So in Chinese medicine, the lung is the prime minister, and its job is to take the orders from the emperor, the heart, and transmit it throughout the entire body. So there's something about the rhythm and breathing that really helps the body get in sync and get on the same page. You can imagine the kingdom of the body is not all behind the emperor, that, you know, there's a little rebellion over here in your left elbow and down on your right knee, that things aren't working together. So as they get communication with the emperor and get on the same page and say, oh, okay, we can get behind this, we can get behind the emperor, that just the body's working in a better stage. So, you know, it might be something. I haven't really thought about that. It might be something to begin to increase the periodicity of that to some point.
You are the host of Lime Ninja Radio. Tell us about it.
Now, that was part of deciding to become an expert in Lyme disease. So first of all, I just love podcasts. I'll put on a podcast, put on my earmuffs and the earbuds underneath the earmuffs and hop on a tractor and, you know, just do the farm work. And I just love listening. I think that's just from childhood. I love listening to information that way. It works for me. So I started looking for podcasts about Lyme disease, and I only came across Katina Makris's show. And in listening to it, I thought, well, you know, there's space out there for another podcast, and people might appreciate it. And if I start a podcast, I can probably get interviews with experts like yourself that normally, if I called them up, wouldn't want to talk to me. So this is a great way to, on a selfish level, educate myself, and then on a community kind of unselfish level, spread my education out with everybody else and let other people learn along with me. So essentially, we interview well, basically two or three different types of people. One, I call them Lyme ninjas, and they're the people with Lyme disease who are dealing with it day to day, and really they tell their stories. And there's something just very healing about hearing another person's story. And we resonate with that, and we feel confirmation with that. We feel that we're not alone anymore. The isolation begins to break down some. So I've gotten amazing letters from people who said, you know, I've been stuck in my bed for the past 6 months, and the only thing keeping me going is hearing, you know, Lyme Ninja Radio. I can't read. I can't even watch television, but I can listen quietly to your show. It doesn't take much energy to do that. And then I interview experts, and some of the experts are experts in Lyme disease and treating Lyme disease, and some of them are just experts in their field. So I've talked with people who are experts in vitamin C or magnesium or vitamin D, and then I've also interviewed, you know, Horowitz and researchers like Eva Shapi. So it's really, you know, there's this wide mixture. And a lot of times it's getting to the point now where people are starting to contact me. So that's interesting. In the beginning, I was all the one reaching out. And so there's really, it's amazing. Like the last interview we just put out there were two young people. They both had Lyme disease and they're both dealing with it and had amassed massive bills, medical bills, and were looking for ways to pay for it. And out of that, they didn't find anything. They're both older than 25, and there's no real charities out there. And the young man, Greg, decided, well, you know what? I'm going to start a charity. So he started Ticked Off Foundation and has done some concerts and some other things. And his work inspired another Lyme patient to say, well, I want to help this. So she's come up with all these kind of alternative ways to raise money to provide grants, such as just recycling shampoo bottles. And so there's this special recycling campaign that she's put together. And I'm amazed by people and their passion and their wanting to help others and reach out. The Lyme community is amazing. And maybe it's like that Mondawmin Mall, the Jewish man, we're all in this foxhole together. So we really kind of pulled together there. It might be that effect. But I'd like to think it's just the generosity in the human heart and that we really have this capacity for love and helping each other.
I think that's a beautiful note to end on. Thank you so much, McKay. McKay Rippey, host of Lyme Ninja Radio, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Dr. Sally.